Good evening, Lehigh Valley. I'm Sally Hanlon, your host this evening for Lehigh Valley Discourse, and tonight we're doing a second segment on the healthcare industry. If you listened in April 2016, we focused on the production of a video called Fix It, Healthcare at the Tipping Point, which was the first documentary of Richard Master and Vince Mandela, who are my guests this evening. At that time, we discussed the rising healthcare costs, impacts on business, working families, etc. There are now over 14,000 Fix-It DVDs in circulation, and it will be available soon on Netflix and Amazon and other sites. But tonight, we're going to focus on Big Pharma Market Failure, which was premiered in New York City in April and recently won the Lehigh Valley Film Festival's Best Documentary Award, and it's now in circulation. We'll provide you with that address, but first of all, let me welcome my guests. Richard, welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
And you've been doing some travel, so I'm going to be interested to hear about this as we talk about Big Pharma.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. And Vince, this is your first time on the show with me, at least, Vince Mandela. Why don't you share with our listeners a little bit about who you are and your background?
Well, I've been doing film and video work in the Lehigh Valley for for the last 20 or 30 years, a long time. And over the years, I've worked with a lot of organizations in the Valley, done regional television programs, and then also worked with Lou Rita on works for the History Channel, A&E, Biography Channel, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So how did you two get teamed together originally?
Well, you know, I got this brainstorm in 2014. I was in Chile with my son and we were meeting our future in-laws, mm-hmm. and he developed an asthma reaction. He didn't have enough firepower in his inhaler, and we went out to the local pharmacy expecting to spend $60 to $80 on an inhaler, hoping that they would respect our requirements without a formal prescription. And lo and behold, we bought one for, less than $15. It was the same one that he got in the United States. I asked them at that point, how about my blood pressure medicine? It was $4 versus 30-some dollars in the United States. And so I came back to at the same time, we were negotiating MCSs. I'm the CEO of MCS Industries. We have hundreds of employees, mostly centered in Pennsylvania, but around the country as well. And we're negotiating a 17-20% increase in our healthcare premium. And I said, enough is enough. And I came back and ultimately connected with Vince, because he's a very respected filmmaker in the area. And I said, we've got to do something modest about this. Modest turned out to be pretty extravagant, and we ended up with a series now of videos on the healthcare sector.
And as I recall, Fix It, your main emphasis at that point was single payer, and you were modeling the Medicare example. Is that still something, and what's happened to that?
Yes, it is. I mean, what we ultimately did is we spent a year in research, and we did traveling and also experienced through some experts, the system, the newest single-payer system was in Taiwan, but pretty much every major modern industrialized country in the world follows in one form or another a single-payer format. They do so because it eliminates the complexity, the multi-tiered level of payers and navigators through the system, and it ends up costing these societies substantially less.
Right.
And what we also learned is that the United States, bit by bit, is being eaten alive by its healthcare system.
Well, as small businesses and those of you listening, I mean, it's not unusual for 15, 20, even 50%, I've heard of increases in healthcare for their employees. You can't run a business when you don't get any return on that kind of expense.
Yes, that's correct. And unfortunately, given the the controversy in the Congress and the lack of a real resolve for reform, we're looking at another set of double-digit increases going forward, particularly for individuals who have to buy insurance through these exchanges.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, thank you both for taking on this initiative and for doing this work. And as Richard mentioned, he is the president of MCS Industries, and as such, he has experienced a lot of the situations with his employees on various levels with the medical scenario. And he has spent, thank you. He spent a lot of time with this research. He just showed me a book of research that they have done for this one we're going to talk about tonight. It's incredible. And so you deserve, both of you deserve a round of support from everybody that's listening. I really want to talk about this big pharma situation, because I watched your video and I listened to it, and originally I was going to take notes and I couldn't because it just pulled me right in, and it really, to me, made me sort of disgusted about our insurance business, especially the pharmaceutical end, and I think they all should have to take a Hippocratic oath. But let's talk about some of the resources, what you did to create this, how it came about and pulled together. Vince, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, well, typically when we're starting these projects, I will choose maybe about a dozen books of key people on the subject. And then from there, we decide who might be really good on camera. So we start gathering up our experts. Mm-hmm. And typically, I think the first film we might have had as many as 60 interviews that we did. And then pharma, I think maybe about 30.
30 additional ones.
30 additional ones, plus some of our originals. So, and I'm reading articles constantly along with the books, and I'm in constant discussion with Richard as we move along. And then he's doing more detailed, refined research that ends up in his very thick book,
mostly of an economic sort. But yeah, we in this case we had Marcia Angell, the editor in chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. We had Dr. Ed Weisbart, who was the chief medical officer for the second leading for Express Scripts, which is the second leading pharmacy benefit manager mm-hmm. in the United States. We had Donald Light, who was the from the Safra Institute at Harvard University, who's an expert on the pharmaceutical industry. Ken Alterson, who's a professor of law and runs the Medicine and Ethics Journal of Law. So we had, I think, the most and many, many more. We had folks who were experts in internationally. Rodman, what is his first name?
Victor
Rodman at NYU.
David Balto.
David Balto, who's was the former policy director at the Federal Trade Commission.
What a
working
lineup.
Yeah, working on, what they're working on is the pay to delay and all the antitrust work that violations that are existent in the industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, mm-hmm. as they, consolidate. They buy each other, raise price, buy each other, raise some more price. This is the pattern of behavior.
Well, and that was one of the fascinating things that came out to me in the video. One of the features that grabbed me was that we're constantly paying for R&D that's already occurred. Mm-hmm. At least that's what we're being told.
Yeah, we're paying for R&D that we paid for,
right.
That the government,
right.
There's a piece in the movie where Senator Durbin gets up and announces that we a $32 billion award to NIH to finance biomedical research in this country. Now, we finance that research. We, through our
taxes,
law,
yeah.
through our taxes, our taxpayers, and then by law, these pharmaceutical companies can commercialize that research and even patent it under their own name. And then they turn around and drugs that cost maybe 5% of selling price to produce are sold for thousands and thousands of dollars. I mean, we saw that with the miracle hepatitis C drug,
right,
the Sovaldi, that really cost $200, $250 for a course of treatment, selling for 80-some thousand dollars for a course of treatment, financed by the federal government.
Yeah. Oh. But the interesting thing is, when we talk about R&D, what's known as basic research, which is the original raw research that gets the ball rolling, a huge amount of that is done by the government and by grants from NIH, et cetera. The pharma companies come in later. Once there's already something hot and it looks like it's got potential, they come in once the highest level of risk has been assumed by the government and the taxpayers. Now, the other interesting thing is, we pay all that front-end R&D as taxpayers, and then we get charged the highest prices in the world. So this is one of the amazing things, is that every country in the world is paying approximately half of what we pay, and we fund it. Yeah.
That was incredible to me. Was this something that you were aware of as you started this? Was this a discovery that you made as well?
We weren't aware of the dimensions of this. You know, it was one of the rocks you look at and you turn over and you see, God, the extraordinary incongruity. This doesn't make any sense, you know.
Yeah.
Why does the Veterans Administration asks one of its consultants to investigate how to cure hepatitis C because you know, all these guys came out of Vietnam with drug problems, mm-hmm. and they are now we're now seeing 30 years later, 40 years later, the deterioration of their liver, and they need help. So this person then gets NIH grants and then decides that he can commercialize this and sets up a small corporation. And then there's a venture capital firm that comes in and buys into the project. Ultimately, they come up with a solution. They take it through FDA and get the first round of approvals and a 90% cure rate. Hosanna, this is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And they turn around and a drug that was supposed to be $20,000-$25,000 a year for they sell that whole system to Gilead Manufacturing for $11 billion. Now, it doesn't go to the government, even though the government's financed most of this.
Right.
It goes to some of the scientists and the venture capitalists, and Gilead turns around and sells this for $1,000 a pill. Yeah. And Gilead ends up being more profitable with a few thousand employees than, you know, Bank of America and Walmart and all these other major companies that have hundreds of billions of dollars worth of revenue, many, many employees, much more complicated operation. It's one of these ugly rocks that you see, and it's just one example of what is going on throughout the industry.
That's incredible to me. The other thing that I was somewhat aware of, but not 100%, was our marketing that our pharma companies do. Listen to commercials on TV, the bottom line is always could create death or something. But every other commercial is a pharma commercial when I watch TV, and other countries don't do this, correct?
It's illegal.
It's illegal.
Only the U.S. and New Zealand does it. And the interesting thing about it, if you talk to physicians, this is a big problem, because a doctor does not want to spend 10 minutes of a 10-minute appointment explaining why that drug is not right for you.
Right.
And the other thing every physician will tell you is that if a drug is truly exceptional and breakthrough, they all know about it. You don't need marketing, because the doctors will prescribe it significantly if that is a breakthrough and a great drug. So the marketing is actually either for equivalent drugs or drugs with a minor advantage but massive price difference, for example, compared to generics. So there's no value whatsoever in most of the marketing that goes on. It's to push me to drugs, which means they're not much better than generics, or a drug that is not considered significant in that particular specialty.
Or the other thing that I've sort of found based on some reading I've done is that it's a drug to counteract the side effects of the drug you're taking.
It seems to happen a lot. But if you look at it economically, you know, I make picture frames, I make mirrors. Now we're starting to make medicine cabinets, et cetera. The way we price our products is about 75-80% of the cost of our selling price involves the cost of our manufacturing, labor, materials, manufacturing overhead. And then we have a modest amount for sales and marketing, and also we make a modest profit, thank the Lord. For doing what we do. Well, these people, it's turned upside down. So 5% is cost or less cost of the of manufacture. So what do they do with the rest? Well, if they're a $500 billion industry, they spend $100 billion on sales and marketing.
Oh boy.
So they've got all these people, a lot of cheerleaders, ex-college cheerleaders, running around the country, pushing drugs in and out of doctors and hospitals, you know, doing all kinds of entertainment and little conferences here and there, and then handing out free drugs so that people would get used to using a particular medication. And then you have this phenomenon of massive television blitzes for drugs that are maybe effective, may not be as effective as or equally effective as a generic drug.
Well, and that was an interesting point I thought that was brought out, that generics can be just as effective, that the subsequent drug is really a derivative of the generic in some cases.
Yes.
And so, you know, as a consumer, we've been told that you should go for the name and not the generic. But it's actually the opposite based on what I saw in your film.
And in fact, we use a lot of generics in the United States. About 85% of the drugs, over 80% of the drugs that are prescribed are generic. France, you know, they use more brand drugs, which is very interesting. They pay a heck of a lot less for them, so they can use the branded drugs. The whole thing is just... It just doesn't make sense.
It's upside down.
It's upside down.
And I think a key point about that is that when the FDA passes a drug, it is not required to compare itself to any other drug that's already in existence, only against a placebo. So that means a brand new, newly approved drug can end up being less effective than every drug out there, including the generics.
Whoa, boy.
And you have no way of knowing.
Yes.
Where that drug fits in.
Listeners, you're going to want to stay tuned because we're going to take a short break, but I'll be back with my guest, Richard Masters, CEO and Chairman of MCS Industries, and Vince Mondello, producer, director, writer of Mondello Video, after this short break. This is Sally Hanlon for Lehigh Valley Discourse.
In 2017, WDIY is celebrating 22 years on the air. If you listen to WDIY, support the station by becoming a member today. Members are our most reliable source of support. We couldn't be here without you. To become a member, visit wdiy.org or call 610-694-8100. WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond.
It's tempting to eat everything at the media buffet.
Television, internet, print, billboards, magazines, vanity license plates.
But binging can be exhausting. You need to know who the media makers are and what's in it for them. On the Media can help you sort through the options.
The Miracle on the Media Diet, served weekly.
Tuesday at 6 p.m., following All Things Considered on WDIY. For program support on WDIY, we thank ASAP Mailing of the Lehigh Valley, a locally owned and operated mailing and fulfillment company offering marketing and production solutions for your custom mail piece, taking your marketing project from idea to delivery, creating a program that meets your mailing, marketing, and fulfillment requirements. For more information, 484-285-0204 or asapmailing.com.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Sally Hanlon, your host this evening, talking with Richard Masters, CEO and Chairman of MCS Industries, and Vince Mondillo, producer, director, writer, Mondillo Video, about Big Pharma. And if you were listening before the break, we were talking about generic drugs and, you know, sort of the ones that are pushed commercially and what that means. And one of the things that the video pointed out to me was that there was this situation of intimidation versus free market in this whole Big Pharma mix-up. So could you guys share with me what that means? And
so regulation versus free. You know, what we're advocating is some intervention by the federal government. You know, and really what we're talking about, Sally, is the roadblock that is currently in Washington, D.C., for any form of reform.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we've seen in with the Affordable Care Act that there have been efforts to reform the system, because the system is financially unsustainable. It's too huge a burden on the federal government. It's now over 25% health care in the United States is over 25% of the federal budget. Even though the government is paying roughly around 50% of overall healthcare cost, so you know what we're seeing is a failure of the government to really rationalize this. The effort in the Congress was really an attempt to shift the cost, not reduce cost.
Right.
And what we're advocating is methods to reduce cost. How absurd is that? Well, unfortunately, when you reduce cost, you're reducing the massive level of profitability, the profiteering that's available to the industries that are benefiting from the healthcare system. It's working. The healthcare system is not working for the American people. It's working for the special interests who supply goods and services.
They should pay for the healthcare system.
Yeah,
get that out of their profits.
Yeah, so what we're advocating is regulation, and what people on the other side are saying is let the free market decide. You know, the free market works in other areas. It certainly works in picture frames, because I've got to be modestly profitable. I have to actually reduce prices every year, increase efficiency in manufacturing. Have the most lean supply chain, et cetera, to make this work. Now, in healthcare, it's not required. We have patents. We have regional monopolies in our hospitals. We have all kinds of things that need to be addressed in a reasonable way by regulation, through regulation, which happens in every other country in the world, but doesn't happen here. Why, and maybe Vince wants to chime in, why, it's actually the subject of our third movie.
To pick up on what Richard is mentioning there, you know, a lot of what exists in the medical world and pharma, these are all monopolies, okay? 50% of the hospitals across the country are in monopoly circumstances, for example. Pharma, if you have a patented drug, particularly a unique class drug, you have a monopoly. So we have no mechanism to come in and control what ordinarily functions as a monopoly. And we have no mechanism, as Richard pointed out, that every other country does, where they literally, they'll look at the drug, they'll say, what is the medical value? What is the economic value? What is the comparison to other drugs in that class, et cetera? And they will do a rational analysis to come to pricing. Here, the only measure is how much you can, how squeezing every possible dime you can, which in the end results in us paying double. Now, how do they do that? The Medicare situation, where we cannot negotiate for drugs, is a couple of sentences in the Medicare Part D bill that basically says Medicare is not allowed to establish a formulary, meaning the list of drugs they'll cover or not, and they're not allowed to negotiate price. So two sentences control billions of dollars and determine how much we pay for our drugs. And why does that happen? It's because Congress has literally two lobbyists from pharma for every single member of Congress.
So there's like 500. So there's like 1,000. Yes.
That is their job.
$300,000 to $400,000 of lobbying expense for every member of Congress, every senator. That's how much is spent. $2.5 billion over the last. Actually, it's $2.4 billion by the Center for Responsive Politics calculation that's going into lobbying Congress just by pharma alone.
Yeah.
Just pharma. Not hospitals, not the American Medical Association, who recently has become more reform-minded. So we do not have, in this respect, we do not have a functioning democracy. The American people, about 80% of the American people, want some form of regulation, particularly for Medicare life-saving drugs purchased through Medicare.
Sure.
Well, and that's what we're advocating in big pharma market failure. At the end, it's a relatively simple fix. There should be the convening of, in each specialty of medicine, a group of specialists who will decide, look, these are at this particular point in time, and they'll continue over time. These are the drugs that should be, authorized for sale in the United States for these particular maladies. And that would establish a formulary once and for all, then continue with continuing update. And then there should be an effort to negotiate price. Well, they're not allowed to do that. And in other areas, the Medicare prices for services are become the reference price for the rest of the system. So we need to do that.
Yeah.
That's a fundamental, basic thing.
I didn't realize until, again, looking at the film, that Medicare did not have negotiation capability with the drug companies. I thought that, all healthcare, they could negotiate, but I didn't realize the difference.
Yeah, that was accomplished when, Vincent? 2003?
Well, when they passed Medicare Part D.
Yeah. It was an outrage to, and there were strong-arm tactics in the House that are well documented, where the bill was introduced, put on the lawmaker's desk in the morning. They said, we're going to vote on this. And by, I think, 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that, they kept the gavel open, the session open, which was also very unusual, and they got it done. The industry got this done, and we're all paying for it.
Yeah.
And this adds to the federal deficit, the national debt. Medicare is really not paying its own way, but it can be fixed.
It certainly
mm-hmm. can, if we just use some simple sets of regulations.
Well, and had used a business model that was appropriate.
Yes, transparency,
right.
Lean supply chain, lean manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and if you just consider very minor example with Canada in terms of their dealing with drug prices, they have one simple aspect of their system, and that is you are not allowed to charge us anything significantly more than the average major industrial countries are currently paying for this drug. I mean, that simple thing, if we applied it to the U.S., would save billions and billions of dollars.
And then, you know, every year we see in some of these brand drugs that they go up double digit, 10%, 15%, and they're allowed to. Well, in other countries, they have an inflation regulator. You can't increase the price on this drug, and there's no reason to. There's no economic reason to, right. Year to, after year, without a showing of necessity.
That's incredible.
There's a price, patented medicine price review board in Canada, and there's one in pretty much every major industrialized country in the world. We don't have one.
But we do in the VA.
Yes, the VA has it. The VA pays what?
40%
less. About 40% less than the rest of the system. Medicaid gets some more substantial discounts. Yeah. Medicare pays more. So it's like all over the lot.
Yeah.
Try to get a price from for a procedure when you go to the hospital.
In advance?
Yeah.
Oh.
I just had an MRI. I called. They called me to schedule it. I said, what's this going to cost? And I heard a chuckle on the other end of the line. And they said, well, I guess you could talk to this person over here or that person. And, you run into down those blind alleys.
And then you get the insurance bill with the cost.
Right,
like, okay,
right. And then
really
you get the
massive
cost. Just give them your credit card and pray.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Canadian approach and looking at the industrialized other countries. They must exclude us from their equation when they put it together, because we're certainly paying more than everybody else when they put that equation together, because it would really rise their costs.
Yeah, we're paying more than everybody else and we're getting less. We're ranked 37th in the world by the World Health Organization in terms of quality and delivery of services, access. And we pay twice as much for healthcare in the United States as the average of the developed countries in the world.
That's
it's incredible. And for, as a business person, think of what that means. I mean, we've heard Warren Buffett talk about this, that the healthcare system, more than the tax system in the United States, he said we shouldn't be looking at taxes, we should be looking at healthcare. Healthcare is the tapeworm in the belly of American competitiveness. That's and I agree with that.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things about this whole issue is that nobody's connecting the dots economically as Richard has, because of his business position. You know, we look at the cost of healthcare. His employees, it's costing you now, what, $10 per employee on average?
About $8 now.
$8 an hour.
Yeah. I hope it doesn't cost $10. Well, we're looking at another increase next year.
How many stories have we seen in the press, in the media, about flat wages? Endlessly hear about flat wages. How many times have we heard that connected to healthcare costs? No. Never. Does not happen. Or how about the fact that a senior that's employed costs a company three times the amount for the premiums? And then if they get sick, that's an additional bump up of their cost. So this is killing employers. And again, when this all started, it was not a major burden to his company. It was a minor cost. But now this is a crisis point that nobody's talking about, the economic implications outside of, you know, these little battles that are going on regarding healthcare.
Well, and you think of, and you know, you look at the private business community, but then you look at our government basis, our municipalities, the pension funds. I mean, all of that is wrapped around this. And
the chickens are coming home to roost. You know, the school systems, massive percent of their revenues go to healthcare, city budgets, and those are our taxes. I just wrote a check out to the Bethlehem school district that sort of, made me really gasp a little bit. And you know, a lot of that went to healthcare.
Right.
People don't realize it.
Yeah,
we've got to do something about it.
according to Mayor Callahan, $750 of your property taxes are going towards health care.
Just for city employees.
Just for city employees.
Yeah. Now we got county employees. We've got school system.
Right.
So it's a big deal.
So we're paying for the research development, we're paying for the drug, and we're paying for the use of the drug.
Mm-hmm. And the guys on who are benefiting from this, and I shouldn't say guys, that's sort of not
right. The individuals.
Right. The individuals are chuckling all the way to the bank. You know, particularly Wall Street has really swooped into this space, and they're the ones that are fueling the mergers and acquisitions and the takeover of generic drugs and the sucker punching the marketplace. One drug, Martin Shkreli,
examples.
You know, you've seen. Mm-hmm. Everyone is aware of those, but really nothing gets done.
Well, it seems like it's so large. Where do you begin?
It's very simple, actually. All these things are they do require some rationalization, a few basic, advances. Single payer would take care of, I would say, 90% of our problem.
Wow.
Centralized financing. We're not talking about the government running the healthcare system. We don't advocate that. That's a English model.
Mm-hmm.
We're advocating more like a French and Canadian model where, the providers of care are private, but we have one payer, and that could be Medicare for all.
Yeah, well, I know. I think just recently NPR had Bernie Sanders talking about raising the issue of single payer among the Democrats in office just to get it up there and to talk to them about it.
Yes.
I don't know where that's going to lead, but it was nice to hear him say that.
Well, speaking of that, what we have found is it's not just a matter of Democrats. What we do surveys when we show our films, mm-hmm. and what we have found is a significant amount of support from Republicans and conservatives, because a lot of the arguments we're making are based on a business economics point of view. And if you're into efficiency, if you're into best practices, if you're into, a whole range of cost reduction methods, this is actually a conservative position. And our feeling is that, the single payer has been too long just an ideological argument between right and left. And we're saying when you look at this, from an economic point of view and get rid of all the ideology, it makes economic sense. And this is never a part of the discussion, even with Bernie.
Well, actually, Bernie just started last Friday did a Facebook page, and he featured our project, and he put on Fix It, Healthcare at the Tipping Point, the trailer. And he said, look, I've been advocating healthcare as a human right, as a basic human right. He said, but there's another perspective on this. It may be the most economically prudent way to organize a health system,
Yeah.
And then they followed along with a whole article and actually a review of me and my work and Vince's work and our project. So I think our presence is now surfacing nationally. Yeah.
Yeah. Listeners, we're going to be closing very shortly on this, but I want to make sure that you have the address of the website to go to, and we'll also have it on WDIY's posting of this show, but it's fixithealthcare.com/bigpharmamovie. So you can see this video that Vince and Richard have put together that is extraordinary. And just a few parting comments. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners?
Sally, I just want to say we appreciate very much allowing us to present today. We appeal to people in the Lehigh Valley area, the listening audience, to really get engaged in this. This is probably the most, significant economic issue facing the United States today.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Vince, for taking the time for being with us today. Thank you, listeners, for being a part of us today. We hope that you got some good information, and thank you for listening to WDIY. Listeners, stay tuned to hear a business update regarding the third biannual Lehigh Valley Meet the Buyers Expo with WDIY's Executive Director Wagner Praviato and David Dunn, Expo Steering Committee Member and AEDC Economic Development Program Manager.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar, every Thursday from 7 to 9, here on WDIY. For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater, Bethlehem, presenting Leaps of Faith and Other Mistakes, blending ensemble acrobatics, dance, theater, and live original music to tell its story. Leaps of Faith follows four friends who set out on the high seas and leave normalcy behind, September 28th through October 1st. For more information, touchstone.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm Wagner Praviato, your host this evening. Tonight, we'll be talking about Lehigh Valley's Meet the Buyers Expo with your guest, David Dunn. Dave's from New York and is a former investment banker. He did expensive work in technology and small business development. He was also a program director at Lehigh University, focusing on small business and technology development. Now he's with the Allentown Economic Development Corporation. And as a volunteer, he's the treasurer for the Habitat for Humanity. And on a side, he's also a paramedic. So welcome to WDIY, David.
Thank you, Wagner.
Let's get right to the questions. What is the Lehigh Valley Meet the Buyers Expo, and why is it important?
The expo is a unique event for buyers and vendors. It's a reverse trade show format, which allows procurement professionals to sit behind tables and meet sellers, the vendors, who are interested in doing business with them. So small business has a unique opportunity to go to this event and meet with buyers that they wish to meet with and provide an introduction, start the format for a relationship development, and hopefully pursue business at a later date.
Great. Tell me about the expo.
So this is the third time we're running the expo. We've run it approximately every 2 years. It's been a very successful event in the prior years. We have upwards of 40 to 50 buyers attending the event, and literally hundreds come to it to provide an introduction to companies that they would wish to do business with.
Okay. And when is the expo this year?
So the expo this year is Wednesday, October the 18th. It's from 8:30 in the morning to 12:30. It's held at the Steel Stacks. People can look at the website to see who's going to be attending that and get a lot of information about the event specifics by going to LV, which stands for Lehigh Valley, Meet the Buyers, no spaces, .com.
All right. So what happens at the expo? What can you expect if you get your tickets and you get to the expo?
What you can expect is the opportunity to meet with right now probably 45 to 50 buyers who are there specifically to meet you. They're interested in expanding their vendor base, and they're looking for vendors, particularly in the small business format. So who should be attending the event? So, you know, we look at it to say, if you make it, mend it, move it, or provide products and or services to business, you need to be there. That means just about every small business connected to other businesses should be attending the event.
Okay, and I understand, of course, Sally Hendlin, who is one of our volunteers, was also one of the people that started the Meet the Buyers Expo about, you know, 6 years ago.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And it is a organization that's run by volunteers like yourself.
We are all volunteers. All of the participants on the side of developing this trade show format are all volunteers, and there's been a lot of donations. There's a number of sponsors as well. Currently, the number of sponsors for the event, there are 11 collaborating partners, all economic development focused, and there are 12 sponsors who are helping to fund the event.
That's great. Now, if you could tell me some of the names of larger and small businesses who are attending, who are the buyers? That's what I'm asking.
Sure. So the buyers really fall into two groups. We have corporate buyers and we have government buyers. The corporate buyers, there are names like Capital Blue Cross, Just Born, Mack Trucks. We have Guardian Insurance. We have Whole Foods. Just to name a few of the currently 45 to 50 buyers who have committed to attend the event. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we have a lot of government participants as well. So if you're interested in selling the government, this event has a whole list of them. Pennsylvania Co-Stars Program, the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission, Lehigh County, Pennsylvania Department of General Services and Labor. The cities of Allentown and Bethlehem will be there. And interestingly, the Department of Defense, the Toby Hanna Military Facility will be there, as will the SBA.
That's great. So if you're a small business here in the Lehigh Valley and you're interested in increasing your business and doing better, it's a great place to go to and meet possible new clients, yes?
Yes. It's an opportunity for you to start to develop relationships. For your marketing dollar, it is probably one of the best bangs for your buck in terms of getting to meet a large number of potential new business partners.
All right. And what types of small business should be attending? And let me follow up with another question, is that how should they prepare for this event?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think any small business that's connected to other businesses and sells their product and services to other businesses, they should be attending. How can they prepare to go to this event? The best thing is really to be prepared. Research who you want to meet, know where your firm can fit in. What is the solution to helping their success, the people that you're meeting with? Understand also how their purchasing, meaning the buyer's purchasing systems, work. What you need to expect to have and what you should have at this event, obviously, of course, you should be bringing business cards. The second thing that you should have is a very strong capability statement. Research how to prepare this. It's a single-page document. It is, in essence, your corporate resume. You can search Google for formats. There are multiple formats that work. But know that approximately less than a third of businesses actually have these and utilize them. It will separate you out and differentiate you from your competition. And the last thing that you should have, and that's really one of the most important things for this event, because it is face-to-face, is you should have a sharp elevator pitch. It's one of the most important steps of this introductory process. You want to give a sharp pitch, and if you have a sharp pitch, it'll open the door of opportunity. So what are the things that you want to do in that elevator pitch? You don't want to sell anything to do with price. You want to think, how can I help your business because we do this? Think, we did this before, and we believe that we can do it for you. In a nutshell, your pitch should convey a couple of important things. Who are you and what you do? An example might be, well, we manufacture custom parts for a specialty steel industry that are used in high-temperature power-generating equipment. That says it all. That first sentence should convey to the buyer what your company does, what product or service that you sell. Think also, what are you looking for? This is a short part of your pitch. Are you looking to do business with medium and larger business that are using products in a special niche? Are you searching for firms that are doing outsourcing of certain parts and that your service business can fit in there? Then what you want to do is define a problem and propose a solution that'll benefit the prospect. Okay, so what does that mean? It means that you might want to say to somebody that you're selling, your firm does services in human resources. You want to convey to them that your system that you use helps companies manage that process so it avoids surprises and fines. These are important things. One other thing that I always recommend people bring to the show that few people do, believe it or not, is a stapler. It allows you to put your take your business card and attach it to your capability statement. It keeps those two items together. While your capability statement should have contact information, your business card is what goes into the Rolodex. I have a favorite saying, the path of least resistance for a buyer always goes through their Rolodex. You want to get in there. This is one of the ways.
All right. That's very good advice. So I appreciate it. And it's funny. All right. So let's say we did all this. Let's take through a scenario. I'm a small business. I got my ticket. I showed up. I did my research. Out of the 40, 50 buyers there, I want to meet with 10.
Yeah? Yes.
I have my elevator speech, as you said, my business cards. I have my staple. Hey, I even have a folder. And I put all my stuff there and I present to you. And let's say that we have a good conversation and I get a contact number. So what happens after the expo?
After the event is just as important as the event itself.
Should I call you immediately? Like in 5 minutes, I should start calling you?
Well, I would say that you want to give time for the dust to settle. Remember that there's probably going to be 200 companies at these events. Each buyer may see 20, 30 or so people. Some of the bigger companies may see even more. They are looking for vendors. They need to sort things out. You need to follow up often, but not too much. Buyers expect you to pursue them. They want you to pursue them. One of the things that Wagner didn't mention is I'm a former business owner. I've actually owned and sold two businesses myself. So I've been through this process just like all of you have, I'm sure, that are business owners. You need to develop that relationship. You need to provide multiple contacts before you can expect an order. And in those contacts, you want to provide new information during your follow-up. It adds to the value of your developing relationship. Things like, for example, you might want to ask if they'd like references, people you've done business with before. You want to provide information. Things like if I mentioned the steel before, so this, you might want to say that that you're expecting that steel prices may change because of a strike at a plant or because of a change in the composition. You also want to know and provide information that, for example, if you're in the service business, that the state is contemplating new regulations or new laws in a particular field. Then you need to also ask, what are your next steps? What are your next steps with the buyer? How can you continue to pursue the relationship? When do you anticipate the next purchase? You have to do the ask at some point. When do you think management will be looking at a particular project or outsourcing something? Or if you're in construction, when will you be bidding out that construction project? Get that. You want to get the invitation to bid. You want to participate in the pool. You're not selling price here. You're selling relationship, and you're selling consistency, service, and quality.
Very good points.
I want to remind listeners again that the Lehigh Valley Meet the Buyers event is a nonprofit event.
David, thank you. This is very interesting and very useful information for small businesses here in the Lehigh Valley. Now, is there something else that you'd like to share with our listeners about the expo?
I think I can't emphasize enough the importance of this event and the value that it provides to businesses that attend. You have the unique opportunity to see literally 45, 50 companies and an opportunity to meet with companies that do what you sell or provide as a service. This is I've been to two of these. This is what will be our third event, my third event. And I can tell you that people who've left the prior events constantly say that this has been a fantastic opportunity for them. And following up with some of them months afterwards, a lot of them have developed relationships with the buyers who are attending and have actually gone on to consummate business.
That's wonderful. So thank you very much. We're looking forward. We are one of the sponsors of the event. We believe in small businesses, and we hope that the third time you're doing it is going to be even more successful than the previous years. Could you let us know again how people can learn more about the expo and how to get tickets and all the good information?
Sure. People who are interested in attending should go to our website. Check it out. It'll have all the lists of the companies. It'll allow you to research those companies before you go to the event. So the website address is LV for Lehigh Valley, Meet the Buyers. nospaces.com. That's the website. Tickets can be purchased online there, and there are discounts for those tickets available for the show and prior to the show versus at the door.
Okay, so Lehigh Valley Meet the Buyers Expo. It will be October 18th from 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 at Steel Stacks, and all of the small business are welcome to attend and hopefully meet and the right connections for you and for your business. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Wagner, and WDIY.
This is Wagner Previato, and thank you for listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY.